I'm afraid he's gone.
Whoa, Doc, I ain't dead.
Excuse me, I believe I'm the doctor.
What we need today is young blood and brain.
There's always a guy going, it's not your fault you're overweight, you're a victim. Really? I don't know. When I was a kid, I was a fat little kid for a few years. And after careful research, I came to the exciting conclusion, hey, I think I've eaten too much.
Oops, lost a nail. Well, that's leprosy for you.
Ah, the hypochondriac's back. So what is it this time? What's
your story? 309 News Talk Radio, 580 CFRN. Welcome to the healthiest hour on radio. With Dr. Barry Dworkin. He's back taking your health-related questions. Phone calls, 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580, free phone call if you're on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-CFRA, toll-free anywhere in North America. Give us a call right now. We want to fit in as many calls as we can in this hour. Encourage you to phone early as the phone lines tend to fill up as we make our way through the hour. Let's get right to the phones right now. Fred in Orleans. Fred,
yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead, Fred.
Hi there. Is Dr. Dworkin?
Yes, hi.
I'm a 46-year-old male, and I've just been recently diagnosed with atrial fibrillation.
Okay.
First bout was in May. I didn't quite know what was going on. I went to the hospital. Like, they couldn't get me out of it with any kind of medication, so I actually had to be cardioverted.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, 3 cardioversions. So my cardiologist says he's got me on metoprolol and flecainide.
Okay.
I still get small bouts of it every couple of days, and it just goes. I haven't been cardioverted since mm-hmm. then, and the medication obviously doesn't seem to be doing it. His next train of thought would be ablation. Is there anything I can do before ablation? He showed me some side effects of it and some risks. I'm not crazy about them. Is there anything I can do besides medicine and ablation?
All right. Cardioverted?
Yeah, cardioversion means it's an electric shock to the heart to reset the rhythm. It's not the full blown, you know, like you see in the show, the resuscitation when someone has a cardiac arrest.
Yeah,
yeah.
It uses much less power to try and convert it. There are a few. I mean, ablation does work quite well. I mean, the other thing to consider is that you're 46, so this is, if left untreated, it puts you at much greater risk over time for stroke, especially if you have your heart. Because atrial fibrillation causes a pooling of blood in the upper chambers of the heart, and that when it pools, you can get clots. And then when your heart starts to beat normally again, it pumps the clot out and can go up into the brain, which is obviously not something anybody would want to have happen. So, I mean, they can adjust. There are other medications that they can try, but the issue becomes the more medications that are used, they tend to go from least potential side effects to most potential side effects. So right now you're using ones that are relatively benign. There still are some side effects. The beta blocker can make you feel a bit more tired.
Yeah.
And the ablation deals with removing the short circuit in the pathway of the heart, literally the wires in the heart that are crossed over that are not allowing it to beat properly.
Yep.
Now, the other things you may want to discuss, if this is a possibility, is there are pacemakers that actually sit and don't do anything until there is atrial fibrillation and they cardiovert automatically.
Okay.
So that is another option to discuss. But there are limited choices because what you're dealing with is an anatomical change in the heart that has resulted in the wires getting crossed.
Okay.
It's not anything you did. It's just the way the heart has developed and what's turned out. So medications will only work a certain...
It's not a cure, right?
It's not a cure because what the medications are doing is it's trying to reset the electrical conduction that is responsible for a normal heartbeat, or in this case, an abnormal one.
Yeah.
And it does that by affecting how the chemical processes go on in those wires to propagate the electrical current through the heart.
Yeah.
And so what beta blockers will do is it slows down the pulse. It prevents that electric pulse from going too fast and reduces the risk of atrial fibrillation. The flecainide also works on particular ion channels, sort of chemical channels, in the wires of the heart and prevents them from discharging too quickly and preventing atrial fibrillation. But there are limits to what that can do depending on, as well, the anatomical changes. So the medication will work sometimes, but there can be other things going on in the heart that are contributing to it, which may require another medication, but then you start ending up with interactions and other problems.
Yeah.
So what the ablation does is it actually deals with just cutting off that signal that's leading to the atrial fibrillation in the first place. But I would be queasy too. I mean, it's understandable knowing that they're going to be wending a catheter through through to your heart, to an area of the heart, and zapping the area that's damaged.
The way I understood it from the dog is it's kind of a guess where he's going and touching. Is that it? Like, or like, is he just going in there, roto-rooting through the heart and
zapping
things?
No, they can't. They won't do that. They know the heart, again, just like we have the anatomy of our bodies and know where all the bones are.
Yeah.
And where the liver is and other organs. There are, within the heart, areas of the heart that carry these fibers. They're called Purkinje fibers.
Yep.
These are the fibers that carry the electrical current. So they will follow a specific path. The issue is where along that wire, along that small segment of muscle that you tend to find this trunk of wire, where in there is the best point to go.
Okay.
So it's not that they're going to affect the entire heart muscle. The guesswork, so to speak, is within that small area, usually along the septum of the heart, which is the main sort of wall that separates all the chambers of the heart.
Yeah.
Okay, Fred?
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
so
good luck.
You do recommend it then?
Well, what I would say is that if the medications are not functioning as they're supposed to and the cardiologist is not happy with that, that means they're concerned that you're at risk. And then if the ablation is what they're offering, that's likely because options of using other medications are unlikely to be effective for you.
Okay.
Good luck, Fred.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
521 Talk, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-CFRA. If you have a health-related question, plenty of phone lines available right now, folks. John in Ottawa.
Yes. Hello, Dr. Dworkin. I got a very similar question to the other gentleman who just called in. I got terminal heart disease, and my cardiologist, he has tried every medication possible to try to stabilize my heart. It doesn't matter what he gives me.
Mm-hmm.
The side effects from the medication that he gives me literally almost gives me a heart attack, and it doesn't matter what he does.
Mm-hmm.
So what can a cardiologist do if a patient, if they constantly give them the medication and they're having side effects, what is the other option they can do with this patient?
Well, now when you say you have terminal heart disease, is it congestive heart failure?
Yes,
basically
there's nothing they can do for me. It's
right.
My heart is pumping so fast that eventually it'll tire it out and it'll stop. And
a lot. Well, the options then are, again, if medications don't work, congestive heart failure, you're very right, John, it is an anatomical problem. The heart muscle itself has weakened to the point that it's not able to forcefully pump blood through. And it is unfortunately a terminal condition. The heart does not repair from that once it gets to that state. So the options are to try to support the heart, as you mentioned, by using medications to try to get it to pump more forcefully and function well. But there isn't anything other than medications or heart transplant which would actually cure that condition. And heart transplants are, again, on the basis of a whole host of other factors to determine whether a person is a candidate for that or not.
So basically it's a death sentence.
Congestive heart failure is a condition that has no cure. So you're correct, and it has a very high mortality rate over 5 years. Usually,
that's what I figured.
It's a 50.
The thing is that, with all due respect, the medication that he's giving me, the side effects are absolutely a nightmare.
Right.
My legs swole. They get swollen even.
Yeah.
Though he tells me to cut down my liquids,
they do get the swelling
enormously, so there's not much they can do for me.
That's the problem, is because you're dealing with an anatomical damage. It's not as if you can go in and fix the heart by operating.
Irreversible.
Once you get to that point, it's irreversible.
Wow.
And so you're faced with, if you get what we call ejection fractions, which are the percentage of blood that is ejected from the heart with a heartbeat, when it goes down below 40%, 30%, your heart is failing, and you can't. There are limitations. We're human. There's limitations with what we can do to fix a heart. And it becomes one where if a person is a candidate, if it's only their heart that has failed and the rest of their body is functioning well, they may be a candidate for a transplant, because that's really the only solution after that.
Good luck, John. I have to run this by you. It was a topic of one of my op-eds this week. It's this ruling out of the EU. I'm not sure if you saw this. But In your medical opinion, water hydrates, right? It hydrates the body, right?
Yes.
No brainer, right? So in the EU, they have bottled water companies. They wanted to make the claim in their advertising that our bottled water helps reduce dehydration.
Okay. All right. As any water would.
Right. So 3 years of study.
Yes.
And 21 scientists, a panel of 21 scientists struck, 24 papers commissioned, and the EU banned water companies from saying that they that it fights hydration. They said it was a false claim.
False that it fights dehydration.
Yeah, a false claim.
I don't.
You're
understand.
Dumbfounded by that,
yeah.
Right?
You,
so are most experts across the EU
I mean,
as well.
It's sort of a specious claim anyway, because I mean, any water will do it. It's not just their
not
brand
just bottled
of water,
water, right? Like it was any, more about obviously yeah. more about advertising and yeah. political yeah, but, motivations,
yeah,
right?
But you're
but they said if you are a water company, if you're a bottled water company in the EU, yeah. and you make this part of your advertising, you'll be violating EU law and you're punishable up to 2 years in prison.
I don't get it.
Don't get it.
I don't get it.
But we haven't woke up in some bizarre universe where water no longer hydrates, right?
If it didn't, you would have okay. plants. That
I'm
going to
show you
either.
This story yeah. during the 3:30 news. It'll blow
right.
you away.
Okay.
Okay. Ahmed.
Yes.
You're on with Dr. Dworkin.
Yeah. Hi, doctor.
Hi.
I have a basic question. I have hand warts for about a year and a half.
Okay.
They started from one each on index fingers.
Yep.
And now they are about more than two dozens.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent about close to $500 in a year and a half to get rid of it by using those acids and over-the-counter medicines mm-hmm. and paying $20 per visit to a poultry medical group to, you know, do that, you know.
To freeze
shaving them off. But they're just not going away. They're actually getting worse. And, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just, you know, they just don't have any solution. And they just said you just have to keep doing it and eventually they'll go away. But I don't think so. I think they will just spread all over, and I'm just stuck here. I mean, they're just very basic, and they say it's not a medical condition; it's just a cosmetical condition. But I don't think so. They're just now painful, they're mm-hmm. hurting, and they're contagious. And I just want to get some other opinion. Like,
okay.
What else can I do?
So you've raised a couple of good issues regarding warts. You know, on the feet, you would have them covered by OHIP because that's what they cover is plantar warts. If they're on your hands, they don't cover it for you, so
yeah.
people have to pay for it. Go figure when you have to use your hands to do things. the issue is that warts are caused by a virus, and,
yeah.
and it's a papillomavirus, which is what causes the eruption on the skin. Over time, what will happen, and this is the frustrating part, is that it can take years for this to happen, and during that time they can spread, is that your body will eventually develop an immune response to that virus and eventually destroy it, and the warts will go away. It's just that it can be highly variable. So ideally, what you want to try to do, because there really are limited treatments for it, it's embedded in the skin. The virus takes over the DNA of the skin and reproduces itself and produces that thickened skin. So treatments include freezing it with liquid nitrogen. You actually have to scrape the wart down. The hard surface acts as a protective barrier. So you always have to, what we call curettage or curette off the top layer so that you have most of the skin where the virus is in exposed, and you have to freeze it with liquid nitrogen and do that for there's three applications of about 10 to 20 seconds each on each wart for a treatment. So if you've got lots of warts, that's a lot of treatment. And so it has to be done properly. There are other agents that you can put on the hand. One of them is called podophyllin, which is you can apply after the freezing is done. Podophyllin is a drying agent. So the issue is, will it dry out some of the cells? By drying out the cells, the virus can't replicate because you're dehydrating them. And as a result of that, the virus dies. But it is always a two steps forward, one step back type of proposition when treating these warts. There have been some studies, but they're relatively inconclusive, in using another compound called Aldara. And it is it's used usually to treat condyloma or genital warts. It can irritate the skin, but it is something that some dermatologists and physicians use as an adjunct, in especially for people who have a lot of warts everywhere, where freezing with liquid nitrogen becomes problematic because it's just too much and very painful on the hand, especially to mm-hmm. use that. So those are some of the aspects of it. The body does develop an immune response, but it becomes an expensive proposition to treat because OHIP will not cover the cost of treating it with liquid nitrogen. And that's where that $20 he's mentioning comes in each time, which is actually less than what OHIP normally pays to have that done.
Okay, we'll pick it up after the news with more of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin here on 580 CFRA and the Wednesday House Call.
Ah, Here we are.
I'm Hadley, internal medicine. And Dr. Lafong, communicable diseases. Dr. Boyer, bacteriology. And Dr. Stinson, Marston and Gill of the Northampton Trauma Institute. And Dr. Imhouse of the Zurich Relief Fund. These are our newly arrived surgeons, Drs. Trowbridge and Greenbaum.
Doctor?
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 And doctor. Well, we miss anyone?
Doctor?
Rob?
341-580-CFRA, giving you a chuckle this afternoon. Here on the Wednesday House Call, and up next with Dr. Barry Dworkin at 521-TALK is Mike in Ottawa. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you, because you were mentioning about congestive heart failure.
Yes.
Like, I have the main valve in my heart that pumps the blood to your brain is closed and calloused, so it only opens halfway.
So you have aortic stenosis.
Oh, that's what that's called?
Yeah, it's the aortic valve, which is the main valve that comes out of the heart that will pump blood through your body. It goes into the aorta, and again, you have blood vessels that break off from the aorta, the carotid arteries that head up into the brain. And a blockage of, if it's a blockage that you're talking about near the heart valve, if that's what you're referring to, that's usually called aortic stenosis. Stenosis means a narrowing or a blockage. And what can happen is when the heart is pumping against a valve that can't open all the way, it's harder to push blood through.
Right.
And because of that, it has to generate more pressure to do that. More pressure means the muscle has to work harder. Because the muscle has to work harder, the muscle can increase in size up to a point. That process is called hypertrophy. Hyper meaning increase, and the trophy or trophic means growth. So it's increased growth. So you get what we call cardiac hypertrophy. Heart gets larger to try and compensate. If the valve remains uncorrected, that they don't open it up or put an artificial valve in there to alleviate the pressure, the heart can only accommodate for so long until that muscle finally says, we can't do this anymore, and it starts to fail. The muscle actually starts to thin out. The heart is unable to pump as effectively, and that can lead to heart failure or congestive heart failure. So the idea is, and again, congestive heart failure, once that happens, is irreversible for most people. So you want to prevent that from occurring in the first place. So for people who have heart valve problems that are being closely monitored, there is a point where the cardiologist and cardiac surgeon will say, you know, now if we allow this valve to continue as it is and we don't fix it, the heart is going to enter into a territory where it will eventually fail. And so you correct the valve before you get there. And when you do that, if you get there and you correct the valve before the heart fails, the heart will actually start to get smaller again the normal way. That is, the muscles will return to normal. So it's literally you're trying to catch this before you get past the point of no return.
Good luck, Mike. Let's go to Stephanie in Ottawa. Stephanie.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so I have a daughter. She's 11.
Yep.
For about 2 years now, she's had this bump on her knee.
Right.
So we've been to the family doctor and had x-rays done. He said it was Osgood Schlatter.
Osgood Schlatter, yes.
Schlatter, okay. Now, I just want to make sure because the internet sometimes can be a curse.
Okay.
There's too much information.
Right.
I just want to make sure, would an x-ray be able to differentiate between the Osgood Schlatter and an osteosarcoma situation?
It would. The x-ray would show a growth in the bone if there was.
Okay.
The fact is that if she's having pain over, it's a bump that's just below the knee itself. That's called
right.
The tibial tubercle. We all have them. In fact, children don't have them when they first start out because it is where the quadricep muscle and the tendon from the quadricep muscles, that's a muscle of our anterior thigh, attaches just below our knee, and it allows you to extend your leg. And where it attaches, where the tendon attaches, is an area on the tibia, and the tibia is the main bone in your leg. And as you move the leg, and especially if someone is very active, they're running and jumping and doing all the stuff that normally kids will do. The bone itself is soft. There's a lot of cartilage in there in children. It's not fully what we call ossified or turned into bone yet, which really only occurs at around 16 to 18 years of age. Hmm. And so what happens is that this bone gets pulled. It ends up getting a bump on it because of this tension from the tendon attaching to it. So you get pain that persists sometimes for years. Mm-hmm. It's on and off, but it does settle down once it ossifies. That is, once it becomes full bone, it doesn't stretch anymore and the pain goes away.
Okay, so her daughter is 11.
Yes, yeah, so
right?
It's okay. You know, it can anywhere between now and 16, it should disappear. So
okay.
She's very active. It's a very common condition. It's especially if you're touching the area and it hurts. Most of the time you don't do x-rays because it's so specific to that area that it really can only be that.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much.
Thank
you're very welcome.
Okay.
We have time for a couple of more calls. If you have a health-related question, 521-TALK, *580 or 1-800-580-CFRA. John in Ottawa.
Hello, Dr. Dorking.
Hi.
Hello, Dr. Dorking.
Hello.
My question is about the eye. Mm-hmm. The injection in the eye with Avastin, is it a good thing?
Well, it's used to treat macular degeneration or wet-type macular degeneration.
I got what they call it, a vein occlusion.
A vein occlusion.
Yeah.
That I'm not sure about. That would be the... I don't have any information regarding that and vein occlusions. I know...
Is the blood leaking inside the eye?
Well, if the blood is leaking, that's... The indication for its use has been, and actually it's Lucentis that they tend to use. Avastin was used as well. It's a very similar medication. Is used to treat the leaking that occurs from blood vessels in the eye that you see with macular degeneration. So I really can't comment on anything other than what it is being used for that I know of, that you would have to take up with the ophthalmologist and say, is this a different indication or is what you're describing to me really macular degeneration? Because it may be that, especially if you're talking about leaking in the eye.
Okay. Sorry about that, John. Let's go to the next call and likely the last call for the Wednesday House call. Doug in Kempville.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
I'm calling. I had both my hips replaced.
Okay.
And the first one was the right hip was about 5 years ago. I've had no problems. It went terrific right from the start.
Okay.
Then I had my left hip replaced just over 2 years ago. Had trouble right from the start with the operation, losing too much blood and so on. Mm-hmm. But my real problem is it's never been right. Although x-rays show that the hip has been placed right, it's way out on the left-hand side in a sort of a hard ball,
mm-hmm.
which is different from the right. And every now and then it seems to enlarge, and then I have trouble walking on my leg. The pain is so bad.
And what has happened to date in terms of them determining the mechanics of how you move? Have they evaluated that? Have they looked and seen what your gait is like?
No, the only thing I was arranged for, my surgeon, again, just looked at the x-rays and said, it's sitting okay. And then he's retired actually
right.
2 years ago. And I just within the last month, I had another x-ray. And again, it looks okay. So I've just arranged through my family doctor to see another neurosurgeon, and she's also going to get an MRI, I think it is, or a CT scan.
The issue is that although it may be placed properly, the mechanics of how you walk and the mechanics of how the hip works can still be off. The other thing, too, is when the hip was replaced, the leg length might have changed as well. And if your leg length has changed, your gait changes, and that can also lead to pain. So it requires not only evaluating the joint itself, which is what seems to have, you know, by doing the x-rays, it can be sitting perfectly well. But if the mechanics and how things were reattached, how the leg is moving now is different, it can lead to strain and pain in that leg. So it's going to require not only the orthopedic surgeon's assessment, but likely a physiotherapist, someone to actually who has expertise in measuring the legs. It's not as simple as people think in terms of measuring legs. And also looking at the feet in terms of support for the foot, because if your feet, if the leg length is different, if the foot is hitting the floor differently after the surgery, it changes everything in how you walk. Even though you may not necessarily feel it or be consciously aware of it, the body makes these adjustments without us really knowing it. And so you probably do have something from what you're describing, because you have a great example of 5 years ago, one hip worked well, and this time around it didn't work. There likely is something a little off. This is the case of where the surgery went as it was supposed to, but your body didn't adapt to the surgical change as well as the other side. And so I would also ask them to refer you for a gait analysis and to evaluate your actual walking and looking at the feet to make sure that you're having adequate support, because I'm sure that's likely a contributing factor to the pain that you're developing.
So a gait analysis?
Absolutely.
And who does that? The physiotherapist?
Usually it's physiotherapists. Sometimes they will do that in the hospital, and the rehab centers will do that as well. But I would speak to your physician, and they can probably arrange that for you.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much, doctor.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for all your calls. And thank you for all those answers.
You're very welcome.
Today, Dr. Barry Dworkin, back on Sunday.
Back on Sunday.
Sundays at 4 with the Sunday House Call and Health Headlines during Maidly in the Morning at 10 minutes before 7 every weekday morning.